Back in business.
Okay, cool. We're back.
We are back.
Rumors of our demise were greatly exaggerated. This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and to help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. Want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group, on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to episode 77 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me, as he always is Mike Morrison. Today, we will be discussing the concept of property ownership inside Star Trek. Mike, it has been quite a while since you and I have had a chance to sit down and podcast together.
It has. Remind me never to switch quarters when the transporters are under maintenance. Ever. I'd never want to do that again.
Is it me, or are your quarters a little smaller? Did you get moved down to the lower decks?
They put me in the lower decks. No. You know, this is an overall effort here on the Starship of Theseus to do things a little bit more efficiently, to maximize space. I've got smaller quarters, but it's cozy, Zachary. We don't call it smaller. We call it cozy.
Well, it's fortuitous that you have recently bought and sold a house. You sold your old house, and you've moved, and you've purchased and moved into a new house. Mm-hmm. We are going to be talking about property ownership today, and that begs the entire question of property ownership. You own those new digs, those new quarters you have, and what a strange notion it is to own something. Isn't the whole notion of property ownership just a strange notion when you really sit down and think, what does it mean to own this object that's not part of me, it's not part of my body, it's out there in the world somewhere, and I somehow have this connection to it. I own it. I own a house. I own, you know, my podcast setup. In Star Trek, like, what do they own? Captain Picard owns the volume of Shakespeare in his ready room, and Loxana Troi owns the Holy Rings of Beta Zed. Like, what does that even mean to own something?
It is a strange idea, Zachary, because at the end of the day, I mean, what do I own? And for that matter, do I really own it? I mean, at this point, I think the bank owns it. I'm just paying for it over time. But yeah, I've got a couple of automobiles that I own. I own my desk. I own the computer. I own this microphone that I'm speaking into. But what, you know, that's an interesting concept, this concept of ownership. And what does that really mean? And when we think about ownership, I mean, we're talking about property, and property is anything that is subject to ownership. I mean, it exists whether it's owned or not. So property is literally anything that's subject to ownership. And you can classify property as property that's correctly owned. You can talk about a classification of property that is incorrectly owned. You can presume to own something that's not property. So this is going to be a fascinating topic. And then to look at this, as we always do here on Metatrex, through the prism of Star Trek, and see how that translates into the Star Trek universe. It's going to be a fascinating discussion today.
Getting back to the bank's ownership of your new quarters, do you think that the Planetary Bank of Beta Zed actually owns the Holy Rings of Beta Zed, and Loxana Troi is only leasing them?
It's just a lease. No, that's really fascinating, because she's very proud of the fact that she is the holder of those holy rings. So I guess she never really says she owns them.
She's
she?
Heir to them, right? Isn't that the
heir to the,
yeah,
use? Heir to the holy rings, holder of the holy rings. So I guess the question of ownership there is definitely in, in question. But, you know, Quark's cousin Galen owns a moon, so I suppose if he can own a moon, she can own the holy rings of Beta Zed.
Well, I almost had second thoughts about talking about this topic of property ownership here on Metatrex, because I think on the one hand, it's obvious that there's property ownership inside the Star Trek universe. There are lots of trinkets and baubles and gadgets and moons owned by different characters inside the Star Trek universe. So on the one hand, that's obvious. But I feel like there's a tension with the maybe the 24th century version of Star Trek, maybe not so much in the original series, but at least in the 24th century, there's largely this kind of non-monetary worldview that's developed, at least in the Federation, right? Where money isn't used on a day-to-day basis. There's no such thing as currency as we know it. When you get into the Outer Rim, so to speak, right? If you go over to Deep Space Nine, then we have gold press latinum and there's gambling. And mm-hmm. Of course, the Ferengi care a lot about owning things. But inside the Federation, I get the sense that not so much. And yet, on the other hand, it sure seems like there are a lot of people that own a lot of things, right? At least have some sense of ownership. So I thought there was at least room to discuss what the heck property ownership even means inside the Star Trek universe. How is it different from how we think of property ownership here in the 21st century? And what role does it play for their society? Those kinds of questions. I think it just wasn't obvious as I got started thinking about it. And I at least see a tension between this largely post-monetary worldview that we see fleshed out in 1990 Star Trek, The Next Generation and Voyager, and mm-hmm. not so much Deep Space Nine again, because they're out in the outer rim. They're out in the outer rim. They're out on the frontier. Exactly. So I kind of bracket Deep Space Nine. I'm thinking of Voyager and The Next Generation mm-hmm. here mainly. This post-scarcity, post-monetary worldview, isn't that almost directly at odds, at least on the surface, with the notion of property ownership? And if not, how do we flesh out what role property ownership plays for people in the 24th century?
Well, Zachary, you are indirectly referencing Captain Picard's statement in First Contact when he says that mankind has evolved to the place where we work to better ourselves. So this idea of money, it's a past concept. At least that's the picture that he paints in First Contact. But you're right, there's a conflict there between that statement and the assumptions that we hang on that statement and what we actually see in the Star Trek universe, circa TNG, Voyager, and so on.
Well, Captain Picard essentially says that the accumulation of wealth is no longer the driving force for us as a people, as a society in the 24th century. But the concept of wealth accumulation is not the same as property ownership in general, right? You can own something without hoarding things, without trying to own more than your fair share, right? Those don't necessarily mean the same thing. So is the notion of this I would say a post-wealth society that Captain Picard is describing, that the accumulation of wealth and by extension money is not the driving force for humans. Is that directly at odds with the notion of property ownership, or are they somehow compatible in some way we've yet to flesh out?
Well, obviously there's some compatibility there, although I will say that I found numerous examples of property ownership in the Star Trek universe. It's certainly not what we see today. You mentioned that I moved, and all kidding aside, and the thing about the quarters, I did. I literally moved from a large house in the suburbs of Dallas to a smaller house. I downsized a little bit, and it was a good move for me. It was a good move for my family, but it came with a certain amount of pain. And the pain was, and I'm going to say it frankly, Zachary, I have way too much stuff. I own a lot of stuff. And to all of the people who helped me with this move, they will agree wholeheartedly, I have way too much stuff. You put that stuff on a truck and you move it from one location to another. A few years ago, I moved that stuff halfway across the country in an 18-wheeler. And so now I have taken almost 2,600 square feet, and I have reduced it down to about 1,900 square feet. I think it's 1,875, something like that. So I had to significantly reduce the volume of stuff that I own. So I sold some stuff. I donated some stuff. We have a wonderful Venezuelan refugee family that my family is connected with. I gave them a whole room full of stuff. They didn't have a bed or a dresser, and so we gave them basically our guest room. And so, you know, the stuff changed hands with a handshake, and so as I've sold things, I've, you know, again, exchanged money for said stuff. And some stuff I just threw away because it didn't have real value. So I just got rid of it. Some things I donated because I didn't want to go through the hassle of selling it for the $5 that it was worth, or at least the $5 that I ascribed to it as worth. So this concept of property ownership is very near and dear to my heart right now.
You know, the only character I can think of in the Star Trek universe who has a problem with too much stuff might actually be Dr. Noonien Sung, who has a laboratory just filled to the brim with stuff. No, I don't see any other character in the Star Trek universe that has too much stuff in his or her quarters.
Yeah, when you're talking about clutter, yes. And that was kind of my point, because we don't really see that in the Star Trek universe. I mean, when we go inside Captain Picard's ready room, or we go inside Riker's quarters, Troy's quarters, Data's quarters.
They're very Spartan.
They're very Spartan.
In fact, Data's girlfriend even says they're Spartan, right?
Yes, yes. And so what does she do? She brings him stuff.
A trinket to fill it up.
To fill it up. And that becomes, and by the way, and we'll talk about this, that becomes quite possibly a sentimental piece of property. And that's part of my problem. And we'll talk about this, I think, a little bit more in depth. In the human psyche, we are sentimental. We attach value sometimes to worthless objects because that object is tied to a person or an event that is significant. And that's been my inner struggle the past few weeks as I've gone through my things trying to figure out what I'm willing to part with and whatnot.
You know, it's interesting that you're heading the conversation in this direction, because I feel like some of the strongest instances of property ownership in Star Trek have to do with things that are sentimental.
I agree.
Captain Picard's brother still owns the family vineyard in some yes. sense, right? That's a family tradition. When in The Measure of a Man, the episode where we kind of establish Data's status as a sentient autonomous being, as opposed to property being property of Starfleet, one of the things that's used by Captain Picard to make the case that Data is autonomous is the fact that Data has this quasi-emotional connection to all of the things he owns, his little holographic statue of Tasha Yar and mm-hmm. his medals that he's earned, and they mean something to him, and he owns them because of that meaningfulness.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned Measure of a Man, Zachary, and I want to talk about that episode because... And that is really a great example of property and the value that we ascribe to it and what it means in terms of our own humanity. That's a fascinating episode all the way around, because what we're actually doing in that episode, we're trying to determine whether or not Data is property.
Yeah, literally, explicitly in the episode, they call yes. the question on the table is whether Data, an android, is property of Starfleet, or whether he's sentient and autonomous with his own rights.
Yes. And one of Captain Picard's best arguments for his sentience, for in essence his humanity, Zachary, is that he pulls out first and foremost his medals. And I actually pulled up the transcript from that episode, and I want to read a few lines from that, if I may.
You
Picard
may.
Asked Data, Picard asked Data, "What are these?" Data responds, "My medals. Why do you pack them? What logical purpose do they serve?" That's a great question. Data responds, "I don't know, sir. I suppose none. I just wanted them. Is that vanity?" Picard says, "And this," and he holds up a book. Data says, "A gift from you, sir." Picard, "You value it?" Data, "Yes, sir." Picard, "Why?" Data, "It is a reminder of friendship and service." Then Picard holds up and activates the hologram of Tasha. And he says, "And this, you have no other portraits of your fellow crew members. Why this person?" And if Data could blush, I believe he would have blushed there. In my headcanon, Data blushes and says...
Mike, we all blushed.
"I would prefer not to answer that question, sir. I gave my word." Picard says, "Under the circumstances, I don't think Tasha would mind." Data says, "She was special to me, sir. We were intimate." I love that because in that scene, Picard is establishing Data's sentience and basically laying out a case that he is behaving like a human because he is ascribed value to these objects.
So I feel like Captain Picard pretty much successfully made the case that Data is a sentient being, at least in some sense, and he's not, strictly speaking, the property of Starfleet. Okay, let's assume Captain Picard made his case there. Has Captain Picard established that Data does, in fact, actually own these trinkets that are used in as examples inside this courtroom trial? Right, so let's take his medals, for example. Data was bestowed these medals, given his medals, in some sense, from his superiors or from Starfleet Command or something. Let's take the book that Captain Picard gave him. He owns this book now because Captain Picard gave him the book. You can kind of push this back, like, well, who owned them first? Like, did Starfleet own the medals? How did Captain Picard come to own the book in the first place, such that he's empowered to gift this book to someone else, and now someone else owns the book? What does it mean to own something? I think merely having an emotional connection to something doesn't account for ownership. There's lots of things I'm emotionally attached to that I don't own, right? So it can't just be the emotional attachment that accounts for the ownership.
Sure, absolutely. You can see, Zachary, our listeners can't see, but you can see that what is behind me here is
things
about half my library.
Like a Packlet would say, things you own.
Things I own.
Things that make you go to work.
But in that library back there are several volumes that were gifts to me, and I keep them because they're gifts.
And you own them.
And I own them. They're mine.
I just keep coming back to the strangeness of that notion. You own them now because someone gave them to you. They were a gift. So now, and legally you probably own them. It's not clear if you own them in any other sense than a legal sense. Like, I mean, in the history of philosophy, there have been various philosophers that have claimed some deeper connection to property ownership. Like, I'm thinking of the philosopher John Locke, who held that the work you do accounts for the ownership. If you are the one who owns the land and goes out and plows the field, you own the fruits of your labor. You own the land. You've worked on it, so you've earned it in some sense. But, you know, if someone just hands you a book and says, "This is yours now," there's a historical antecedent to that, right? You know, someone else, you know, was gifted it, or someone else bought it and they worked for the money, and, you know, it's kind of this historical chain of events that led to someone owning a book and being able to gift the book. But it's not obvious at all what ownership even means in that sense. I mean, yes, you can be gifted something and so you own it. Legally, that's probably true. But in some deeper sense, other than just strictly speaking, arbitrary letter of the law, you know, you own it because the law says you own it. What is the deeper sense of ownership, like working the land and owning the fruits of your labor, that kind of deeper connection?
Right, right. Zachary, I believe it was Socrates who surmised that all property is subject to sovereign control by some human being. Someone somewhere has the ultimate decision-making power over any said property. And I think that's interesting. And there's a conflict here in the Star Trek universe because oftentimes fans have a tendency to place the Star Trek universe into something that resembles socialism, probably more so than capitalism. When we talk about owning property, I mean, that is the foundation of a capitalist society.
Well, at least if you think of property ownership in terms of individual property ownership, as, you know, one person owns whatever he or she owns, as opposed to a society owning something communally, or even in Star Trek, Starfleet can own something communally. Like, something can be the property of Starfleet, not of an individual.
Well, and that was the tension of Measure of a Man, because the case was... the case was argued that data was a piece of property owned by the Federation, and because of such, with a simple order, his autonomy is gone, and so he can be disassembled and sold for scrap if they wanted to, because he, after all, was their property. I can pull a book off of my shelf and I can go out and I can burn it because it's mine. I can give it away. I can hand that ownership over to somebody. And I did that this past week. I gave several volumes from my library, books that were very good books, but they no longer have use for me as I'm downsizing. I've read at least one of the volumes that I gave away. I've read several times, and I probably will never read it again. So I gave it away to someone. I transferred ownership of that to somebody else. And so I have the power to do that because it's my book.
I guess the fundamental question I have about property ownership, maybe two fundamental questions. One fundamental question is there some deeper sense of property ownership, again, in Star Trek or even here in the real world, but by extension in Star Trek, but you know, is there a deeper sense of property ownership like John Locke's notion that you inherently own something because it has something to do with your natural rights as a sentient autonomous being, whether human or not? In the case of Data, he's not human, but he's sentient and has rights as established in the measure of a man. Or is the concept of property ownership merely a legal construction? Is it a social contract in the sense that, say, the philosopher Thomas Hobbes would have thought of it? Like, you don't inherently own anything, but we kind of develop this social fiction of ownership to create an orderly society so we don't have to worry about our goods being stolen from each other. It creates an orderliness and a security. Or is there some deeper sense, like you genuinely quasi-metaphysically own something that, because you're entitled to it because you have labored for it? You know, is there that deeper connection or not? And okay, so that's one question. And the next question I have is whether or not there's actually a robust sense of individual property ownership. I think we definitely get Starfleet owning things, right? You know, the phaser that someone uses in Star Trek is not owned by the individual, it's owned by Starfleet, property of Starfleet. In fact, you can imagine these little property of Starfleet stickers placed on the back of all the machinery and goods and equipment used in Star Trek, right? It's like property of, you know, property of Apple or property of Starfleet. But do individuals actually technically own things in some deeper sense, right? Does Captain Picard's brother actually own the family vineyard? Does Captain Picard own the things in his ready room? Does Data really own that statue of Tasha Yar such that he's entitled to it in some sense? Or is property ownership thought of as more communally or more, I don't want to say socialistically, but more communally? Or is the very notion of property ownership just an antiquated notion? The fact that the quarters we see inside Star Trek are so Spartan, I think there's almost like this virtue that's been developed of austerity. Like, I don't need all the clutter. We don't focus on wealth and accumulating material goods in the 24th century. So I still need some things to get through, and I still have a couple sentimental trinkets, but I don't own anything beyond those. Is there like a boundary that's been placed on individual ownership as a result of this kind of stoic, kind of the stoic austerity that we see in the Star Trek universe? Really, because I think, you know, if I were on the Enterprise and I had a replicator, my quarters would be filled with stuff because I'd be replicating it all. But you don't see them doing that in Star Trek. And if they do, they go, oh, I've replicated this thing that I need. Now let's toss it back in the replicator and recycle it. Right? They don't accumulate things. And that's different than how we think of ownership. So, you know, what is the sense of property ownership in the first place? Is it this deep sense, or is it just this agreed upon fiction? And then, do individuals in Star Trek actually own their goods, or is there something more subtle? Are there some limits either socially or culturally or legally placed on individual ownership in Star Trek in the 23rd and 24th century as opposed to us here in the 21st century?
Well, you know, it's really fascinating because If you look at early Christianity, and I'm going to lean on my background a little bit in religion and in theology, when you look at the early Christians, they came to a realization that they didn't own anything. God owned it all. And so we read in the book of Acts, the early Christians, right after the ascension of Jesus, They sold their possessions, and they gave the money from that to take care of the needs of the others within their groups, within their church, it came to be known as.
Yeah, property ownership was at odds with the ability to take care of the group in that way and care for other people. Right.
Exactly. And what they had oftentimes is argued that it looked very much like socialism. And there are, I think, similarities there, although it wasn't. It's not the state saying, it's all for the good of the many, but rather it was driven by a sense of charity in the heart of the believer that caused him to see a need and realize that the way to meet that need, the way for him to bestow charity, was to let go of that which he owned. However, in Buddhism, there's an idea, and Buddhism, by the way, precedes Christianity by thousands of years. They propose that desire is one of man's major problems. So it's not enough for them to abandon property, but they go through this mental and this emotional discipline and this disconnect from their desire for that property. And so in order to achieve nirvana, the state of transcendent nothingness, they have to not only release the stuff, but release the desire for that stuff that drives man to want to own things.
So the situations you've described, especially the situation with early Christianity, is interesting because I think it is an excellent example of the fundamental economic principle of scarcity. Right. There are not enough goods to go around, not enough food, not enough clothes, not enough shelter, not enough fill in the blank to go around for everyone. And that creates a situation of suffering, potential suffering for people, actual suffering for a lot of people. And so, insofar as hoarding wealth, accumulating goods, property ownership in general, by extension, I think the situation you're describing is that this strong notion of property ownership in that early Christian worldview or mindset is at odds with the ability to take care of the group. But that's because of this fundamental condition of scarcity. But in the Star Trek universe, the problem of scarcity is largely eliminated, right? They can replicate food. They can replicate clothes and material goods, right? So there's no, I guess the situation is just different because, the accumulation of goods, you could replicate, say you go to the ship stores and you replicate, like Worf does. He says, I'm going to replicate these monstrosities of a candle holder, these glass candle holders for, for a wedding. You just created material stuff. Like someone's going to put it on a shelf and collect dust. That does not create pain for anyone else because there's essentially no problem of scarcity, at least inside the Federation in the 24th century. Right. So why would there be such a concern about property ownership as a potential cause of harm to other people? I totally get that in the early Christian mindset, if you own things, you were directly harming someone else because you were taking away something that could benefit someone else. In the 24th century, it just feels like that problem has been solved. So in that situation, why has the concept of property ownership diminished rather than flourished? If everyone can own everything and no one is harmed by it because we can replicate goods ad nauseum, as many as you want, why the taboo, so to speak, on owning too much stuff?
That's a great question. As I said earlier, I feel like having just moved, I own way too much stuff. And
send some to me, would you? I'll sell it and make a buck.
I'd never want to do this again. This moving is a painful process, even under the best circumstances. And it's been very, very difficult. And so I'm finding that parting with stuff can sometimes be pleasurable and it can sometimes be painful because I've ascribed value to certain objects. And some of those objects, Zachary, quite frankly, in the eyes of anyone else, is worthless. For instance, I have tons of things that my daughter made me in school and they have value to no one else but me, but I've kept them. I moved them, halfway across the country 3 years ago, and I just moved them 30 miles up the road a couple of weeks ago, and I've kept them because they're priceless to me. But to you, to anyone else, they would be, you know, worthless pieces of paper mache.
Again, though, the question I have for you and for our listeners is whether I'm making a mountain out of a molehill here. Is there a genuine issue of property ownership in Star Trek, or is it totally obvious that people own things in Star Trek? I don't think it's obvious at all. We see several things that are property ownership, like Data and his trinkets, Picard and the stuff in his ready room, Captain Picard's brother's vineyard. But is that genuine property ownership, or is it merely property ownership like?
But that's, I mean, you mentioned Picard's brother. So the Picard family owns a vineyard. We know that from the episode Family. Picard goes back to
the family. He got gypped. He didn't get any of it.
Yeah, he gets back to the family farm.
Out of his inheritance.
Yeah, he gets back to the family farm, and his brother is still bitter that, you know, that he left to go explore space. He should be there. This is the family farm. This is ours. This belongs to our family. So there's a deep connectivity to that land and to the product that they're producing, the Chateau Picard. Sisko in Deep Space Nine, he buys land on Bajor.
Okay, no, this is a great example. I want to return to the vineyard thing for a minute, because I think this is part of the fundamental question. So, on the Picard family vineyard, the Chateau Picard estate, there are a certain finite number of grapevines, right? And that means they can produce, at most, a certain volume of wine, assuming they're not replicating the wine, assuming they're doing it the old-fashioned way, as Robert would do, right? He wouldn't replicate his Chateau Picard. He would produce the genuine article. That means there's a scarcity of Chateau Picard, right? There's not enough for everyone. Not everyone can have a bottle of Chateau Picard. That creates economic value. That's how we think of economics, right? That means there's a quasi-monetary value associated with this scarcity of Chateau Picard. How do some people get Chateau Picard, and how do others not get Chateau Picard? What decides who gets to own one of these precious, quasi-rare, finite bottles of Chateau Picard? And why do some people get left out? How, without money in the picture, and without some sense of certain physical goods being worth more than other physical goods, some sense of quantifying value, what dictates who gets to own one of these precious bottles of Chateau Picard?
Maybe you can win one in a poker game.
You can be gifted one, right? Captain Picard could give you one, or Robert could give you one, right? Just like Data was given his medals and Data was given his book by Captain Picard. But that doesn't really explain the problem, right? What entitles some people to own one of these bottles of Chateau Picard, and other people are, you know, they get the short end of the stick. They're not fill in the blank. They're not honored enough. They don't have enough 24th century clout. I don't know how to describe it. But clearly not everyone can have one.
Well, here is some of this tension. And I think, at least in my mind, Zachary, I think there's a huge assumption here. We know that within the Federation, they don't use said currency, but some of that is assumption to some degree. You know, we see it on Deep Space Nine. We see gold pressed latinum being used to buy and sell things.
And in all fairness, in the 23rd century, we do have credits that are used to at least purchase tribbles.
Exactly.
Gems.
And you made my point. Even with the replicator, Zachary, oftentimes you have to have replicator credits. Sisko mentioned using his transporter credits to transport himself back home in the evening. I mean, there's an allotment here. They're giving out allotments of these things.
And even on Voyager.
And those things can be used. I mean, man has been, since the days that they traded stones, for Pete's sake. I mean, you think about the things that we've used for money in the history of mankind. We've used rocks. We've used livestock. We've used people.
In Voyager, they use replicator rations.
Replicator rations. Yes. I mean, it seems to me that it is ingrained into the psyche of mankind to ascribe value to something, to use that for currency, and to buy and sell. And I honestly, and maybe this is a question for somebody much, much more intelligent than I am, I honestly can't go back and pinpoint a place in history where that wasn't the case.
But what you're describing to me sounds like a backward step. We have a fairly evolved sense of currency, I think, honestly, right? We can do math with it, right? We can do supply and demand curves with it, right? We can quantify value to the point where we can create equitable trade to some degree in some Adam Smith Wealth of Nations sense, right? But in the 24th century, as you're describing it, it almost sounds like they've devolved back into a barter system. Like, okay, so here's Robert Picard, and he's got his, you know, fill in the blank number of bottles of Chateau Picard. And now who gets to own one? Well, who can convey something of value to him that's not quantifiable? It's not money. It's not currency. But who's going to scratch his back such that the person that scratches his back gets one of these precious bottles of Chateau Picard? Doesn't that sound less evolved than this nice, predictable, quantifiable, mathematically concrete sense of currency that we have here today?
It does sound less evolved, but I have to say that, Zachary, at least to me, it sounds incredibly practical. I see a practicality in a barter system. I have something that you value, and so if you want it, you need to come up with something that I would value. And I think that's incredibly practical. I hate to keep using that word.
But sure, but how?
I think it's the best way to describe it. It's practical.
But how does the fact that a great many people in the 24th century, definitely people in Starfleet, maybe people in the Federation in general, maybe some larger group of people, seem to have cultivated this virtue of keeping their own desires in check, right? It makes sense, I think, if you go, I need a lot of things and I desire a lot of things and I've got this precious stash of Chateau Picard and now I get to decide who gets some. Well, I still desire a lot of things, and so whoever can give me the stuff I want gets one of my bottles of Chateau Picard. That, I think, makes total sense. But in the 24th century, they've also learned to check their own desires and minimize their excessive desires. Mm-hmm. How does that influence this 24th century barter system that you're describing?
Yeah, well, again, when we talk about a barter system, I think we've established that there is some system of credits being used, so we don't necessarily know that it's a barter system. Maybe that bottle of Chateau Picard does have a value of Federation credits. We don't know that. There's a lot of assumptions being made about the monetary system or the lack thereof in the 24th century.
I can kind of picture the 24th century equivalent of Facebook ads like Chateau Picard on sale this week for only 200 Federation credits. Get it today while it's hot. Right. I mean, that's essentially what you're describing. If there is actual monetary value, then you're really describing an economy. And I don't think you get to have it both ways. How can you have an economy where there's still some sort of scarcity that mm-hmm. isn't driven by this need to own more than other people? Like, you know, I just don't see how that would be. I mean, once you start heading down that slippery slope of having an economy, I think it degenerates into the situation we've had here in the real world awfully quickly. And you don't see that degeneration inside Star Trek, except maybe, again, if you're Ferengi or if you're, you know, out in the backwoods where it's more like a strong economy without regulation, without oversight, without whatever keeps our economy organized, right? But I don't get the sense that that's what's going on in the 24th century. Like, does Robert Picard actually care is he trying to maximize the number of credits he gets for his Chateau Picard?
Price gouging.
Well, it's a very good bottle of wine.
24th century price gouging. Are there
24th century advertising companies in Star Trek?
Well, you know what's interesting? Texas is still recovering from Hurricane Harvey. And I just want to give a shout out to any listeners that we have in South Texas in the Houston area. Also over in Florida. You know, our thoughts, our well wishes, our prayers are with you guys as you continue to to dig out and recover from those terrible storms. But and I have some connections down in the Houston area, people who have been going through that. But immediately after Hurricane Harvey made landfall here in the Dallas area, and again, for our listeners that don't realize how big, I'm going to go all Texas on you, how big the state of Texas is. And Zachary, you've got this to some degree.
Is it as big as Captain Janeway's ready room?
It's bigger than Captain Janeway's conference table, let me tell you. It's huge. This is a big state. And it's funny because I kept getting these wonderful notes of concern from people. Hey, are you guys okay? Well, you know, we're in Dallas. And Dallas is about 400 miles from Houston.
Yeah, I was going to guess like 300, 400.
It's huge. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's about a four-hour drive. I can make the drive from Dallas to Houston in about 4 hours. And that's because we drive real fast here in Texas. But, you know, there's quite a bit of distance. But immediately after Hurricane Harvey made landfall, I've digressed, here in the Dallas area, there was concern that there was going to be a shortage of gasoline. And so there was a run on gas here in the Dallas area. Of all weekends, Labor Day weekend.
It sounds like the plot of a Dallas episode or something.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. I witnessed it. Gas became very scarce. And so the price of gasoline went up, supply and demand. Gas stations started raising the price of gasoline.
Are you sure that J.R. Ewing didn't engineer that hurricane?
If he did, I'd shoot him.
There's an outdated retro reference for anyone who's younger than us is not going to get that.
Who shot JR? I did. I blame
JR for the hurricanes. I don't know.
We had a classic case of supply and demand, and it jacked the gas prices up. In fact, gas prices are still elevated a little bit here in the area. They're slow coming. They were quick going up. They're slow coming back down. And in reality, we didn't really have a gas shortage. We just had a panic, you know, and that inflated the price of gasoline. So we see how the economy can be affected by different factors. You mentioned scarcity. And so scarcity is one of those factors that affects an economy. So we don't really see that in the Star Trek universe. And you're right, Zachary. I can only assume that the needs and expectations of people have somehow evolved. And maybe that's a post-apocalyptic, you know, type war. I mean, we know that World War III was a horrible thing. And, you know, we made first contact after that. And I think the combination of the war and the scarcity and meeting the Vulcans and this kind of period of enlightenment for humanity, maybe that had an effect. But as you and I joked, you go around to the quarters and it seems that they own very few things.
Well, the situation you're describing in Texas, which is a potential gas shortage and the mm-hmm. economics of that, I'm trying to think if there's an analogous situation in Star Trek, and I think there is. In the original series, there's a constant need for dilithium crystals.
Yes.
And we often see Captain Kirk negotiating for some trade agreement to obtain more dilithium to keep the Federation ships going where they need to go, just like the trucks in Texas need to go where they need to go. and so, you know, if there's a space hurricane on, you know, planet X where they mine dilithium, does that create a run on the price of dilithium? You know, does Captain Kirk have to pony up a bit more in terms of Federation goods to obtain the dilithium that the Federation and Starfleet needs?
Well, and interestingly enough, I mean, we saw a mirror universe example of how there are two different attitudes. Mirror universe Kirk was willing to kill to get dilithium.
And don't even get him started on those Spikem flame gems. If he'll kill for dilithium, he'll do unspeakable things for Spikem flame gems.
And for that matter, Zachary, I mean, we have an example in Enterprise. The episode Marauders comes to my mind, where these Klingons are just raping and pillaging these humans who are mining deuterium on this little wasteland planet. And, you know, if it weren't for Captain Archer stepping in and doing something about it, he was there to actually buy. He was trying to buy deuterium or trade for deuterium. And they didn't have it because these Klingons were coming, and they end up helping them. And in return, they get the deuterium they need plus some. But I mean, there's an example of how the desire for something can actually lead to negative consequences over this lust to have something.
So what is the correct Star Trek takeaway from that episode? I think there are at least three takeaways. One takeaway could be that this notion of scarcity, this fundamental economic concept, is the precondition for bad things in the world. That's the reason that people rape, pillage, and plunder, right? It's the scarcity is the precondition for war, for strife. Mm-hmm. That's why the Klingons are doing this, right? They want that deuterium, come hell or high water. Another takeaway could be Captain Archer's standpoint that what you want, given the fundamental condition of scarcity, there's not enough deuterium for everyone. What we want is free trade, right? These people who are laboring with the sweat on their brow to produce and mine and store this deuterium should be paid a fair price, whatever that means in terms of credits, in terms of other goods that they need. Maybe metaphorically in terms of respect, who knows, right? But fair trade, you know, it's not, it's not anti-currency or anti-trade or anti-economics. It's that there's a fairness to economics that is not being displayed in that episode by the Klingons. The third potential reading of this would be that scarcity is bad. We need to, you know, and by extension, economics is bad. The whole, this sort of more utopian 24th century version of Star Trek thinking, right? That we need to do away with the entire concept. If we can solve the scarcity problem, then we can do away with economics and we can create a utopia where everyone sits around and plays classical music on the Enterprise. Right? So which is the Star Trek interpretation of this condition of scarcity that's established inside that episode, Marauders of Enterprise? I don't think it's obvious at all. Maybe all three, but those are not quite compatible with each other, right? So I think the one is maybe the first interpretation that scarcity produces bad effects. Maybe that's not even a takeaway. That's just an explanation of the preconditions for these things that are brute forces reality. There is conflict. There is strife. People do try to steal things from other people, and it's an explanation of why that occurs. Okay, there's no deep takeaway there, maybe. But of the other two standpoints, what is the end goal? Is the end goal to produce fair trade, where if we need deuterium and the Federation has something else of value, then we can do some sort of mental math on the back of a napkin and figure out what's worth what and come up with a fair trade, and everyone's happy with it? And it's very much, it's an economics, but it's a fair economics. Or does Star Trek force you into the direction of this post-monetary, post-economic, post-scarcity utopianism that we see in later iterations of Star Trek? I don't think it's obvious at all which is the correct takeaway. I think we see examples of both takeaways in Star Trek, but I'm trying to step back a little bit from Star Trek and ask the deeper philosophical question of what is the best takeaway? what's the best direction for future society to go? Do we continue down this economic path and try to equalize it and make it as fair as possible? Or is there a post-economic future for us as a species, as a world, as a galaxy that is conceivable and not internally inconsistent in some way? It's something that's actually possible and worth striving for.
I think it's difficult to discern, Zachary. In the Star Trek universe, it's extremely difficult to discern. And when you ask which takeaway or both takeaways, I think that's what makes Star Trek terribly hypocritical on this subject, because out of one side of their mouth, they say that it's kind of this post-economic. We work to better ourselves, and you know we're not driven by the desire to possess things, and yet the Picards have their vineyard, and Chakar's got his farm, and Sisko's got his land, and they own pets. Picard's got a flute. Riker's got a trombone. He gives it as a gift to Thomas. They're example after example. And don't even get me started on Fazio from most toys, because...
Well, I think you could bracket him, because that's an example of illicit trade, right? He's not part of Federation society. He's on the fringes. He's in the black market, right? He's not part of normal society.
But look at his motivation, his drive. I mean, his drive to possess things is all about his own personal status. There's no real, he doesn't ascribe any kind of sentimental value to the things that he has. It's all for a show.
But Mike, I don't even think you need to go all Fazio on me. I think you can look at almost anyone inside the normal Federation society, not black market society, not Deep Space Nine. We're talking normal, run of the mill, you know, carpet on the walls, 24th century society. Those people, talking out of both sides of their mouth, will say, I'm too good for property ownership, but get me one of those bottles of Chateau Picard. Right?
Zachary, I'm speechless. Yes, I mean, absolutely. I think you're right. And again, I go back to these examples in Star Trek of the sentimental value that's put upon the things that these characters own in the Star Trek universe. Sisko's baseball. It was a gift to him. And it became a symbol of his presence. I mean, that baseball was his promise to return in Deep Space Nine. Gul Dukat knew that he was coming back because he left the baseball.
So, okay, I want to drill down on this a little bit, because I think in the case of Captain Sisko, okay, he's got this baseball and it's sentimental and everyone respects that. The crew on Deep
Space... Let me go a step further with that. In the episode The Search, that's season 3, episode 1, Sisko and Jake are returning to the station from Earth and they're unpacking some things. Jake finds an African mask. And he talks about his dad's African art collection. And they just brought this Yoruba mask and all of these other ancient artifacts back from storage. They got it out of storage. And Jake comments that now Deep Space Nine is home because his dad brought those items and they're now there with them on Deep Space Nine. So those items... They tied him to that. They were a declaration that this is home. So there's great value placed on these items. And wherever these items are, that's home.
Okay, so...
That's fascinating to me.
I'm following your reasoning. I think there are some...
Home is where my stuff is.
there are some gray areas. Like, does Captain Picard's family still own the vineyard in some ownership sense? What about Data's trinkets in his quarters? Does he own those in some sense? I don't know. But if we've zeroed in on the things that are sentimental, like Captain Sisko and his baseball or his masks, whatever they are, right? Why don't we see more in the way of property ownership disputes inside Star Trek? So why don't we imagine, you know, some random starship captain, not like Captain Picard, who has no kids, but someone like Captain Jellicoe, someone who's a family man. You know, he's a careerist Starfleet captain, but he also has a family and he's got some descendants. And he's got some sentimental trinkets that he has accumulated in the course of his travels. Spike'em flame gems. He's got, you know, maybe he stole Captain Sisko's baseball, you know, whatever. He's got some sentimental items that he owns, in irony quotes, maybe he quote unquote owns them. Now, when that captain passes away and he's got descendants that all want a piece of the sentimental action, they want that baseball or they want those Spike'em flame gems or they want whatever was in his ready room because he did this great thing one time on a mission with this stuff in his ready room. And so it's important and they have to have it. Why don't we see more in the way of property ownership disputes, even maybe especially, but even about the sentimental things that people obviously seem to own inside Star Trek? You know, I guess I'm wondering, like, we know there's a JAG unit inside Starfleet, right? We see that in the Measure of a Man. Do you think that the revered Judge Aaron Saati presided over many, many a property dispute case in the course of his lustrous career?
My father was a great man. His name stands for integrity and principle. You dirty his name when you speak it.
I do have an example to offer, Zachary, but you're going to slap it down because
I mean, I, it,
It occurs on Deep Space Nine, and that is the episode Who Mourns for Morn.
Right, exactly. People want Morn stuff.
Right. I mean, people were coming out of the woodwork. I mean, a woman come up out of a mud tub, for Pete's sake.
If there's ownership,
trying to get her piece of Morn's latinum.
If there's ownership, there has to be inheritance. And we don't really see much in the way of inheritance disputes, even over these sentimental things. I mean, maybe we just don't see it. There's lots of things we don't see in the Federation. Maybe it exists and it's just... Sure, it exists in the background, just like Chekhov is there in season one of the original series. He's always in the bathroom or something, right? Maybe they're always doing these property ownership cases in the JAG unit in Starfleet, and we just never see it.
And there was a legal process in Who Mourns for Morn, and it was Odo who was kind of presiding over, who was directing that process. So we know that there's a legal process somewhere out there in Federation space that governs the transfer of property when somebody dies, for example.
But again, I feel like the fact that I could say all of that in this, you know, very ironic, you know, exaggerated tone, you know, the descendants want a piece of the action with all the sentimental stuff, points to how absurd that is in the fairly utopian view that Star Trek presents of the future. The fact that these, you know, antiquated 19th, 20th century concepts of property ownership and the court system and how disputes get resolved. I mean, that shows that there are all of these antiquated economic danglers in the 24th century that aren't a natural fit for the utopian view of what humans could be and should be.
Well, Zachary, I think that is indicative of the real world problem that we have, and that is trying to break away as a species, the human being breaking away from this notion of ownership and economy. And I mean, we've experimented with socialism and communism, and it's failed.
Can you imagine on Deep Space Nine if someone broke into one of the shops on the promenade and, you know, stole some stuff, and then Odo catches the perpetrator?
Some jum-jum sticks?
Yep. And then
who stole my jum-jum sticks?
Can you would the defense be something along the lines of, there's no property ownership in the 24th century, so there's no stealing, right? That maybe that's not a natural fit for the 24th century either. I think if our legalistic mindset about property ownership and how property ownership disputes are resolved isn't a natural fit for the 24th century, I think neither is this radical rejection of property ownership, right? A criminal who steals stuff can't get off on the defense that there's no property ownership anymore. Right? That doesn't seem to fly in the 24th century either. So reality's got to be somewhere in the middle.
Yeah. I think about the Next Generation. I can't think of a single example of, you know, a theft occurring. I mean, with the exception of the most toys, where data was stolen.
So I'm trying to think of examples of theft inside Star Trek: The Next Generation. Definitely, we have Fazio trying to steal, you know, trinkets and artifacts from the past, including data, rare artifacts. But we also see in the episode A Matter of Time, we see Professor Berlinghoff Rasmussen, who claims to be from the future but is actually from the past, stealing and pocketing items from the Enterprise to take back to the past to try to profit from them, to claim he invented them and to make a buck, essentially. But it's clearly done in the guise of stealing. He is stealing stuff from the Enterprise. Now, is he stealing? It doesn't seem to be stealing individual people's property, right? He's stealing Starfleet property. He's stealing technology. He's stealing a tricorder, and he's stealing some other associated, the hypospray, right? He's not stealing Data's sentimental objects or sentimental objects from Captain Picard's ready room. He's not stealing that bottle of Chateau Picard, right? He is stealing Federation property or Starfleet property at that point. But it's still done in the guise of theft. He is actually a thief, and he is stealing stuff to make a buck, and he's stolen from someone or something on the Enterprise.
But what's interesting about that is that it's peddled to us as he is somebody from the past, therefore he's less evolved.
That's my point, right? That is my point. He's from the past. That is an antiquated worldview, and future humans in the 24th century who have that evolved utopian mindset wouldn't deign to own property and be as unevolved as Professor Rasmussen.
Yeah, we never steal because we have everything that we need.
Right. And that's my point. That's the vision that's the narrative that's told about humans in the 24th century, right? And that is at odds with all of these instances of actual property ownership and all of these instances of an economy or an economy-like transaction, like obtaining a bottle of Chateau Picard, that we've talked about, right? There is a tension there. It's not obvious that how that tension is resolved, even given all of these examples we see in Star Trek.
And again, we see lots of examples. I've been rattling them off here and there. Janeway's coffee cup. She gets a gift from Chakotay. What does he give her? He gives her a watch. Yeah, it was a replicated watch, but it was a watch nonetheless, and it had sentimental value. I think about Harry Kim. I'm going all Voyager on you, Zachary, because I know you're the Voyager wonk.
Me?
Harry Kim and his his clarinet and Tom Paris.
And his television his set.
Television. So there are lots of examples of property ownership. But I think at least the concept that's being presented to us in the Star Trek universe is that in the future, humans have curbed their desire for stuff and therefore need very little.
You could even go so far as to say that let's take all of these people who are in Starfleet and say they have voluntarily signed away their rights to property ownership. Just like here in the real world, if you sign up for the military, the military owns your rear end, essentially. You know, yes, technically on paper you might still own stuff, but seriously, the military owns you, right? For all intents and purposes, for the duration that you're signed up for.
Well, we call them GIs because they're government issued. They're owned.
Exactly.
Owned and moved and...
Now,
ordered? Yeah.
Let's assume something like that is happening in the 24th century. Maybe everyone in Starfleet has signed away their rights to property ownership and everything is owned by Starfleet once you're enlisted. There are still civilians who are not in Starfleet, not in even quasi-military organization, right? What about those people? I'm almost interested more in the Robert Picards than I am in the Captain Picards in this situation.
Yeah, I was going to say, we've gone right back to... Robert Picard and your example of the Picard Vineyard.
Yeah,
Chateau Picard.
And pick your favorite civilian. And you know, I can understand in Starfleet, there's an ambiguity, right? Okay, you're in Starfleet. You don't own a lot of stuff because you're on a starship and it doesn't matter anyway because we have replicators. So I get all of that. But let's set all of those people aside and talk about ordinary run-of-the-mill civilians in the 24th century. Do they own things?
I don't know. You know what's funny to me is that anytime you see an example of a Starfleet officer coming on board, I mean, when we first meet Bashir, I mean, he's got one bag over his shoulder. That's his stuff. That's all. I have to wonder, Zachary, you know, I'm sure that he had things that he possessed. You know, when he stuck him back in the replicator and recycled him, did he save the replicator patterns? And so when he gets to his new place, he's going to replicate all that stuff all over? I don't know. I don't know the answer to this.
See, I guess I just don't buy this 24th century vision of desire, right? In Star Trek The Next Generation, it's like, it's not okay to desire the baser things in life. You can't desire wealth and you can't desire fill in the blank that is not in line with the utopian vision of humanity, but it's okay to desire things like Chateau Picard. And it's okay to desire things like violins. If you want to play orchestral music and tend forward, there's lots of things that seems to be okay to desire, but there's like an arbitrary line. Like these things are baser and beneath us. And it's not okay to desire those things anymore. And over here we have the utopian whitewashed carpet on the walls, things that are okay, socially acceptable, not taboo to desire. And if you want to replicate one of those, knock yourself the hell out.
You know, you mentioned something a moment ago, and that, as I've sat here and I've thought about it, that has piqued my curiosity. And that is the concept of self-ownership.
I think if it's plausible that you own anything, it's plausible that you own your own being, your own body, right? That you could get to dictate what happens to you. So I think that makes total sense. And that's the question with Data. Does Data own himself? Does he, right? Does he have the autonomy, the self-ownership to dictate his own being and his own future and his own consequences? I think that for biological beings, sentient biological beings, that's totally obvious, right? We own ourselves. We have the right to dictate our own trajectory. Right. And that's the question for Data. Is he one of those beings that has those rights, or is he not like that? But I think that the matter is fuzzied when we're talking about owning things that are outside of you, like the coffee cup here on my table. I own that, but what the hell does that mean? What kind of connection is that? I think that's massively less obvious than this notion that you own your own being, this notion of self-determination.
You know, it's interesting because, again, in the Star Trek universe, we make the assumption that they own themselves, but, I mean, Guinan actually brings up in Measure of a Man the concept of slavery. And, you know, this very dark chapter in our own history. They eliminated it in Europe much sooner than we did here in the United States. And for that matter, it still goes on. I mean, human trafficking is an ongoing problem within the world. And it's something that we can't afford as human beings to take our eye off of. This concept of people being property and being bought and sold as property. And Guinan makes this point within Measure of a Man. And so the question of our autonomy, our self-ownership, that is a question that has not always been one that's been resolved. We haven't always had an answer to that because we have traded, bought and sold people as property.
But it actually sounds like the concept of ownership in the sense of self-ownership, like I own my own being so I can have autonomy and do what I want to do, not what someone else wants me to do. That the concept of ownership in some narrow sense, like self-ownership, a restricted sense, not being owned by someone else in the sense of slavery, right? But owning your own being. It seems like that concept is actually helpful for explaining this notion of autonomy and self-determination. The language of owning yourself.
You know, it makes me wonder at what point. I mean, there's a process where a child first becomes conscious of himself. And he awakens to maturity and recognition of his full self. And he or she become owners of themselves. That's fascinating to me because, you know, for instance, you know, I'm raising a daughter. She's 15 now. She's coming to the place where she's gaining some independence. But, you know, there was a point in time where, you know, if I told her to go left, she went left. If I told her to go right, she went right. And I was doing it lovingly and I was teaching her, I was protecting her, but she wasn't fully her own. She couldn't do as she pleased. And for that matter, she still can't to some degree. Although, as any good parent would, we're trying to give her more and more freedom to do so.
Yeah, and legally we kind of draw an arbitrary line in the sand. Like, okay, when you turn 18, then you're autonomous and you can actually own things and you can actually make contracts and you can actually have self-determination. And we just draw an arbitrary line. So I guess I'm interested in the non-arbitrary line drawing. Like, what do you do that actually entitles you to property ownership that isn't just some statute-based legal arbitrary line in the sand, like, oh, you get to own stuff now because you've passed this arbitrary line? What in the 24th century in Star Trek and here in the real world, and for John Locke back in the day, is it plowing the fields that gives you ownership over the fruits of your labor? Is it the work we do like I work from home, and we both work from home now, actually, now that I think about it. You have a new job and we both work from home. I do labor for someone else. They pay me and then I own that money and I can go buy stuff that I own because it's transactional. And you can kind of retrace the causal chain of events, the history of transactions that lead to the things that I own. Or, and what is it in the 24th century? What accounts for the sense of ownership? If it's not transactional, if there's no currency, and that, again, with a big question mark, maybe there is currency in the form of credits that persist into the 24th century. We don't ever really know, I think.
We don't know. Yeah, that's just it.
But what is it? Is it labor? Is it statute-based in some legal sense? What other basis could there be for property ownership besides the things that are obvious that we've already fleshed out? Maybe that's the end of the story. Maybe people still do work in the 24th century, and so they get credits, and so they own stuff. It could be that simple. It could be that there's an arbitrary line in the sand, like maybe Judge Aaron Satie sat on his bench somewhere and decreed that, you know, when the father of Captain and Picard and Robert Picard died, that someone gets to inherit the stuff and Robert Picard ends up with the vineyard. And maybe that's just established by statute and that is the end of the story. I guess my point is that those answers are not terribly satisfying because they don't explain this deeper sense of ownership. You know, yes, you can explain everything by statute. The law says that blah, 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 blah. And so you own this and I own that. And that's the end of the story. That doesn't answer this deeper kind of, I want to say metaphysical, but deeper moral sense of ownership. Like, I am entitled to this because I have done blank. I've worked for it. Right. What is that notion like in the 24th century? And is that different than what we have here today? And is it different than just pure statute? I mean, because I guess, you know, practically speaking, there are disputes and they need to be resolved. And there's a JAG unit and someone has to decide where the lines are drawn in the sand. And it all seems very arbitrary. Is there some deeper sense? And if not, it's awfully dissatisfying because I don't think the legal answer actually addresses the deeper philosophical question.
We've been talking a lot about coffee cups and flutes and trombones.
Television sets.
And even bottles of Chateau Picard. Let's shift gears for a moment. We talked about self-ownership and we touched on those dark chapters of slavery in our own world and how that translated into the Star Trek universe. Let's talk for a moment about pet ownership. As pet owners, Zachary, you with your cats and I with my dog, I'm glad to see that pet ownership is alive and well in the Star Trek universe, but those are not the hell your whales. And I just want to make that clear.
No, this is a great point, right? It's morally wrong to own another human being because another human being is sentient, should be autonomous, should own him or herself, right? Okay. In Star Trek, we get a lot of quasi-sentient beings. Whales are sentient. Can we own whales in some sense? It doesn't seem like in the 23rd century, it's like set the whales free to save the world, right? No one's owning the whales in Star Trek 4. It's bad to own the whales and keep them in a cage.
Those are not the hell your whales.
But we do see Data owning Spot, and Spot is less sentient than a whale? Is it a sliding scale? Is he not a sentient being in the sense that whales and humans and Klingons are sentient? We don't ever really
Archer
know.
Has Porthos.
Right. Is it
moral? Spock had a Salot. So
is it morally wrong to keep Porthos imprisoned in Captain Archer's ready room? Right. I don't think it's obvious, but I think it's an interesting sliding scale. I think sentience could plot. We don't really know because we don't really know what it's like to be any kind of being other than ourselves. But presumably sentience is like a sliding scale, right? A human seems to have abilities or some degree of consciousness or self-awareness that is at least different than what other animals have. Different than, the great apes, for example. Different than whales. Whales and dolphins. They're mammals. They're intelligent. They've got big brains and seem to have intelligent behavior. Now let's drill down a little bit. What about lower, mid-grade animals? The Porthos and the Spots of the Star Trek universe. They are not as sentient, not as intelligent, don't have the same self-awareness. But it's not at the level of an insect or not at the level of, not at the level of a neural gel pack on Voyager, right? Right. So, okay, it could just be a line drawing problem. Like, again, arbitrarily, it's like these are the sentient beings that have rights and these lower ones are not sentient beings and they can be owned by Data and Captain Archer, respectively.
And here's something that I really love. And we get to see it in the Star Trek universe. And that is a human having to take responsibility for the actions of his pet. And we see that in A Night in Sick Bay. Captain Archer has to, in a very elaborate way, apologize because, Porthos did what dogs do their tree.
A holy tree was disrespected. Do you think that happens on Beta Zed? Do you think the holy rings ever get, urinated on or, dare I say it, defecated on by random quasi-intelligent life forms? Or even the intelligent ones, for that matter.
Well, I'm sure if it did, Zachary, Loxano,
that happens here too.
We would hear about it.
Once in a while, you see intelligent humans, relieving themselves in any random place. It doesn't even have to be the lower life forms, at least here in the 21st century.
But again, I mean, pet ownership. We get to see it in the Star Trek universe, and It's obviously carried over, but
is it more like pet stewardship than pet ownership, though?
Yeah. And again, I was kind of going to make that point, you know, here in our world, you come by a pet, you can be given a pet, you can rescue a pet. But even with pet rescue, typically you're going to pay something in order to get the pet, services rendered by the shelter that you rescued the pet from. People purchase pets all the time. You go to a pet store, you go to a breeder, and you can purchase a pet. There's a responsibility that comes with pets, and that's a monetary responsibility. If a pet gets sick or, you know, you spay and neuter your pets, oftentimes that costs something.
It can be a liability, you know, if your pet causes harm.
Sure.
Monetary liability. Yeah. In some legal, at least in the legal sense. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I half jokingly threw out the term pet stewardship versus pet ownership. Do you think that a more useful way of describing this quasi ownership, this quasi property ownership that we see in the 24th century, that we, again, I'm not totally convinced is the same concept of individual ownership that we know it here. Do you think that it's more enlightening, more revealing of what's actually going on in the more utopian version of Star Trek in the 24th century to call it property stewardship versus property ownership? Do you think that in general, that when we're talking about people owning things, they think of it more like stewardship and less like, this is mine, I own it, poo on you?
I'm glad you said that, and for this reason. Earlier, I mentioned the attitude of the early Christians, and again, we can read about this in the book of Acts, written by one of the disciples named Luke, who was a physician and a historian, and he chronicled the acts of the early apostles, the early church, that first century, first generation of Christians after the ascension of Jesus. And within the church, as it became known, there was that desire to meet a need and this attitude that I can sell what I own and use the proceeds to take care of the needs of my brothers and sisters within the church. And that attitude comes from a sense of stewardship. So in reality, in typical Christian doctrines and teachings, it is a stewardship. I in all truth, I own nothing.
I think you're hitting on something. So you're drawing a theological analogy here, and I totally get it. In the early Christian church, people didn't actually own anything because technically, quote unquote, in that worldview, God owns, created, and owns everything, all of creation, right? All of the universe. Now, maybe in the 24th century in Star Trek, property ownership is only an illusion, and it's allowed only insofar as the Q continuum allows property ownership to take place. We're just stewards of the Q continuum.
Actually, I was going to say, Zachary, that it's all a Talosianic illusion.
I just want to clarify, I meant the Q continuum, not the great material continuum.
We're all stewards of the Q continuum.
The Ferengi think you're stewards of the great material continuum. The rest of us think that we're just stewards of the Q continuum.
And then, of course, you have those who think that it's all an illusion by the Talosians. And isn't that indicative of our own world? I mean, you have theologically driven people who believe that we're stewards of, in your example, the Q continuum, that could represent those who have a more theological worldview. You have a certain sect of philosophers who believe that it's all an illusion. I mean, what is real? And we can really drill down into this ownership question into a, you know, what is real? You know, this is all a Talosian illusion. You know, it's all a menagerie.
You know, here in the real world, we sometimes get those not quite genuine pastors that are like, they'll drive the fancy cars and they've got the fancy clothes and they're, you know, sort of preaching, you know, God will make you rich. That kind of worldview. Yeah. Can you picture like the Ferengi doing that? Like they're all dressed up with their bling and their fancy cars. And they're like, you have to have faith in the great material continuum.
I think we see that in
the continuum. Voyager. The continuum will provide. Hallelujah.
Yeah, I think we see an example of that in Voyager.
We're just stewards of the continuum, man. Here's the collection plate. Well, Mike, we've been talking for over an hour, and I'm not sure we've raised the bar in the depth of our philosophical analysis of property ownership, but I think we've shed light on the difficulty of explaining property ownership in Star Trek. I think when we first started the discussion, we could plausibly say that, look, why are we talking about this? This is obvious. People own stuff in Star Trek. There's all kinds of objects and trinkets and things, and people seem to own them, and there's some disputes, and there's a JAG unit. It's just like here in the real world. So why are we making an issue of property ownership? I think we've drawn out any number of different tensions and difficulties in explaining what exactly the sense of property ownership is in the 24th century, because it sure seems like it's different than it is for us, given the difference in background conditions, differences in scarcity, differences in worldview, differences in how people think of themselves and their potential as in relation to property ownership or things they could own, the role of material possessions in living a good life in the 24th century. So I don't think we've actually solved any issues, but I think we have shown that this is not obvious at all. And there seems to be something property ownership like in Star Trek, but it's not as cut and dry as it is for us here in the 20th, but it's now the 21st century.
Well, you're exactly right. It's not cut and dry. I think there are some potential explanations in the Star Trek universe that could possibly answer the questions of why this tension exists. You know, we mentioned, you know, the war and evolution of mankind after the Third World War, maybe changing the mindset and so on and so forth. So I think there are some potential, or there rather is some potential for explanation within the Star Trek universe, but it's not cut and dry, and there are no easy answers, and it almost seems like a hypocrisy within the Star Trek universe to some degree when we really kind of dismantle this idea of property ownership and whether or not people own anything. But again, Zachary, I think it can be argued that it's all an illusion. It's a menagerie and nothing really exists, therefore.
Yeah, I guess that's my point. It's like some things are totally okay and socially acceptable to own, and other things are taboo and they're less evolved and they're remnants of humanity's sordid past, right? And there's some sort of kind of arbitrary line drawn between those two things. And if you're erring on the side of the more civilized notion of property ownership in the 24th century, like striving to get a bottle of Chateau Picard, to reiterate the ridiculousness of that idea, that's okay. But it's not okay to be Fazio and collect, to hoard these artifacts, right? There's some arbitrary difference there. And is it hypocritical? I don't know. There's a difference. Is it a genuine difference or is it a pseudo difference? And, you know, are our favorite protagonists of the 24th century blameworthy because of it? Can we call them out as hypocritical? Like, they really have all these same base desires. They've just couched it in terms of more socially acceptable outlets than humans of centuries past.
Yeah, it kind of makes you wonder if Picard would have been willing to trade a bottle of Chateau Picard, a very rare vintage for Data in most toys.
You're hitting on something. Captain Picard should have offered Shinzon a bottle of Chateau Picard, and then Data would have got out of there scot-free.
Darn straight.
Got to use the tools you've got.
Drink this, it'll make you more like me.
Exactly, it's in your blood.
Well, Zachary, it's been fun talking about ownership in the Star Trek universe, but this isn't the only thing that we've been discussing here on the network. So here's a quick look, everyone, at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Melodic Treks.
I really like the two Fairhaven episodes that we got. I know a lot of people are either very hot on these episodes or very cold on them. They've never bothered me. I think they're a lot of fun. And they're silly, but whatever. But one of the things that's really cool about them is we get something different in the musical field for Star Trek, with this wonderful Irish-style music.
Earl Grey.
Well, I just noticed mine deals with all naked people.
Richard!
What? Wow! All right.
Wait a minute. Oh, Justice Tappich, you're right.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
I just noticed that. I was like, oh.
There's nudity in each of those episodes.
Well, then.
TVMA.
Warp 5.
It was a weekly thing. It was originally on Tuesdays. At some point, Tripp decided to make it a nightly thing, or at least that was his idea, but then it went back to a weekly thing. I'm like, that sounds just like my life, because this is the type of thing where it's like, yeah, you get together every Tuesday, and then you gotta wait a whole week, and at some point you're like, we should be doing this every day.
To the journey!
Yeah, I mean, the way that he behaves towards B'Elanna is kind of... He gets a bit creepy there.
Well, he gets punched too, just like Joe Carey, so...
He does. B'Elanna makes a habit of punching her staff.
It's team building. It's like trust falls.
It is team building. Maybe it's like some kind of exciting club.
Yeah, I've been punched by B'Elanna Club.
I've been punched by B'Elanna, and I'm obviously now in the inner circle for engineering.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Well, check out all these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please, leave us a star rating and written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and in most third-party apps. And you can stream and download the MP3 file always from our website or grab the RSS link as well. Well, we'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways for you to share your thoughts with us. The best place to join the larger conversation is the Babel Conference, our listeners-only group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. It's a closed group, but if you click join, someone will let you right on in. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the contact form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose Message to a Trek FM Show and select Metatreks. That'll come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. Well, Zachary, when you're not coming up with clandestine ways to get your hands on a bottle of Chateau Picard, where can people find you on the network and around the interwebs?
Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek.fm as co-host of To the Journey, Trek FM's podcast dedicated to all things Star Trek Voyager, along with my two co-hosts over there, Suzanne Williamson and Kay Shaw. You can find me in the Babel Conference if you'd like to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with me over there. And you can always find me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And how about you, Mike? When you're not artificially inflating the price of Spike'em Flame Gems, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, Zachary, you can always find me on Facebook. That's where I'm most active. Certainly, you can catch me from time to time around the Babel Conference. On Twitter, my Twitter handle is at cmichael1701. I'm occasionally on Instagram, also cmichael1701. You can read my blog about my journey to publish my novel. That is cmichael1701.wordpress.com. If you'd like to help us keep all our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more. Available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of time and money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. Well, Zachary, we'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the Metatreks team from around the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek FM. He owns it all. Our executive producers, Matthew Rushing and Ken Tripp, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Richard Marquez, our production manager, our Patreon manager, Brandon Shea Mutala. We'd also like to give a special shout out to our associate producers here of Metatreks. We'd like to thank Patrick Devlin. You can connect with Patrick on Twitter. His Twitter handle is at MagicDrop5. Kay Shaw, your co-host over on To the Journey. Her Twitter handle is at Choco Weeble.
She owns Kay owns everything in the Delta Quadrant. I'm just saying.
It's all hers. Our good friend Norman Lau, his Twitter handle is @Starfighter1701. And Zachary, we have a brand new associate producer here on Metatrex, Mark Walker. Mark, we don't have your contact information, your Twitter handle, so if you'll reach out to us, we'll be glad to share that here on the podcast. We want to thank you for your support of Metatrex and of Trek FM.
I felt pretty bad because Mark's been waiting quite a long time for his Metatrex associate producer credit. He signed up as an associate producer for Metatrex just before we took a 5-week break while you moved out and into your new quarters. So, Mark, we're glad to have you as an associate producer on Metatrex. Send us your contact information and we'll add it into the show.
Yes, welcome aboard the Starship of Theseus. And Patrick K., Norm, and Mark, we just couldn't do it without their support. Zachary, we want to take a moment to acknowledge our sponsors here on Metatrex, Enterprise in Space. Be sure and check them out. It's a project of the nonprofit National Space Society. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. And check out audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Well, thank you, everyone, for listening to Metatrex, a Star Trek and philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.
There's no crying. There's no property ownership in space.
It is a frontier, and eventually that frontier will be divided up and zoned and
right. Barbed wire fences around it all.
We're going to build a wall. It's going to be a beautiful wall. It's very, very lovely.
Keep your targs off my lawn.